Wednesday night. We hope that you are happy, healthy, and safe wherever you are tonight. You're listening to the Patty Vasquez Show, 720 WGN. And a few months ago, I had the pleasure of meeting our guest. He's somebody who has an incredible journey that he's offered to share with the world. This isn't an easy thing to do. Parm Parasuran. Did I say it right?
Yes, absolutely.
Well, you're going to just lie to me now, aren't you?
It's not bad.
He's written the book Perfect Pain, and I went back and I reread some of the beginning of it because it's such a journey. You start, Parm, with the story of, you know, kind of hitting almost rock bottom of someone saying, I didn't know what I was going to do when someone told me you were dead. And you take us to this journey of from your childhood, your family fleeing Iran, your journey to the United States, having to sort of always reinvent yourself. And I want to know, when you decided to write this book, because you established that early on, that sometimes revealing the biggest tragedies or struggles of our lives can inspire others. You know, maybe you're not changing the world, but maybe you can help one person at a time. And I know that through the book, you also explain more about why you wrote this book, especially at the end. What has been the reaction of the people in your life when it comes to sharing this with the world?
Well, I would split up into multiple different categories the reaction of the people in my life. So if you speak about just the people directly around me, we can talk about that too. And then there's a segment of people that have read the book and are reaching out to me.
Right.
As far as the immediate people around me, I think it's what you would normally think. You know, they're proud of you. Just finishing a book and publishing it is an accomplishment. But it's more just that the people that love you are just happy for you, as if no differently than if Patty Vasquez gets her own show and things like that. The reaction that I think is, you know, that's really interesting is the people that don't know me or barely know me or just flat out reading the book. Because one of the things that's happened that's really, really surprising is the number of people that have reached out once they have read the book.
Mm-hmm.
And they are from various, you know, different genders. Actually, I would say pretty mixed, different. But the biggest thing is the scope of age differences. And that's been the most unique experience, is the people reaching out. Now, I wanted people to reach out, or I wanted people to be
making that connection.
I want to make a connection. I want people, because I have, and we can talk about it later, but there's some real purpose that I had to why I did this. But the people reaching out secretly was the phenomenon that was very surprising.
Oh, and that's a lot to take on, though, too. And you mentioned early on, you said that you knew the title of the book before you even put pen to paper.
Absolutely.
Tell us about the Perfect Pain.
Yeah, the book idea actually came when I was in a fairly good place. And the idea was, and, you know, the conclusion the book really brings about is I was in a place where I felt like people have challenges, and challenges are relative, right?
Right.
You have challenges. I have challenges. Everybody has different challenges, and they're all unique to you and they're relative to you. But what I had this overwhelming feeling was of pure that I was so lucky. I just felt extremely blessed. Someone may read the book and be like, wow, how is it that you feel extremely blessed? You've had some chaotic stuff happens, as do many people.
Right.
But I just felt extremely blessed. And the reason I felt extremely blessed, and the reason it was called Perfect Pain, is that I felt the amount of pain I had was perfect, in the sense that it didn't go over the bridge. I didn't, you know, I got very close to crossing a line that maybe I can't return from, but I didn't cross that line.
And that line could be losing your life,
different people,
losing your family,
different jobs. Different. I mean, it could be losing. Yeah, you know,
all those.
Yeah, it could be anything. Yeah.
When you talk about not regretting, not having a regret for all the things that have led you to this point, and that's really hard for people to do. They regret something that they've done along the way. And how do you find that space? And of course, you have worked a lot with a psychoanalysis, therapy, sitting in a room once a week with Dr. Jekyll.
15 years.
Wow. With the same doctor?
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Well, I over 1,200 sessions now.
Oh, man.
It's crazy.
Does he want to write a book about you?
it's an amazing, I don't even know. When I started out, I would never thought 14, 15 years from now, 1,200 sessions later, that this would still be going on. And I feel like it's still like I'm in third grade.
Well, and we can go back to what led you there and the things that you couldn't necessarily sink yourself into. My father was an alcoholic and never voluntarily went to AA. I mean, he would go on benders. I would go find him in a bar. He'd be there for, you know, gone for 3 days. I would steal his pickup truck and go look for him at the neighborhood joints. And, you know, I'd have to clean him up. He would, you know, soil himself and vomit on himself, and I'd have to bring him home. And it wasn't until he was arrested, straddling the double yellows on Milwaukee Avenue, and not only arrested, but also charged with trying to bribe a cop, because he was quoted as having said, "Come on, even God takes money." But when he went, he always said that it wasn't the AA that made him stop. It was just that this was it, right? And he hated AA. He hated, you know, the whole give me the serenity and all the prayer stuff. And that doesn't necessarily ring for some people when they're in that situation, does it?
Very different for different people.
Yeah.
Very different. You know, my wife, ironically, her dad was also is alcoholic as well.
Mm-hmm.
Very similar to the way you describe things, and ironically, you know, she married somebody that was having, you know, very some similarities, and there's a lot to that. So I'm very familiar with that, and you know, he did the AA thing, and you know, I have friends that did the AA thing. I have no problem with it. It's just a path.
Right.
It's just different than the type of path and the way my mind works. However you get there is the first part, is the quitting of whatever you're doing.
Right.
But what I care about is not the mechanical work of quitting. I want the healing of, like, the real whys of the internally where it just is right. Not like forcefully, I'm never going to do this again.
Right.
I want you to know, why did you do it in the first place? And why were you there in the first place? Very difficult conversation with a lot of people. First of all, people don't even like having that conversation.
But. I know my dad never got there. And he turned to other addictions then after that. I mean, it was
like
gambling, and then he smoked harder. You know, there are folk. And I do want to say, for anybody who is like my dad and like yourself, where something doesn't necessarily cut through or it doesn't appeal to you, it doesn't mean that there isn't something for you. Like, some people feel as though they're failures then if AA didn't work for me, right? Don't you think they'll give up then? They're like, well, that's not for me. I can't be saved.
Yeah. And AA is mechanical. I think it's I think
and it's so good for so many people. I mean,
it really is. Yeah. And I have to be careful, because I truly don't know that much about the inner works of it.
Right.
And how it works.
Because you kept looking for something that did work for you.
I did. Right. I need to understand it conceptually.
Right. Right. And that's a thing. For some people, it does speak to them. And sometimes it's based on whether it's your religion or your upbringing. And as you mentioned, you know, also it could be part of what led you to do the things that were harming you in the first place. And if you're not able to, if some people can just sort of box that away and not have it affect them, maybe, or so they think. And so that's manageable through different programs. But for you, I mean, you did the deep dive. So let's talk about that when we come back. We're talking to Parham Parastaran. Nope, didn't get it. Pastor, nope, say it for
me. You did Parham perfectly.
Parham, ma'am. Parham. More with Parham. He's written the book Perfect Pain. It is available on Amazon.com and anywhere where you purchase books. Do you have a website in particular you'd like me to direct folks?
The simplest way is perfectpain.com.
Perfectpain.com.
Yeah, and then everything else is on there. There's videos and there's more information about the book.
Great. More with our guests when we come back. It's the Patty Vasquez Show on 720 WGN. If you have any questions or comments, you're welcome to join our conversation anytime. 312-981-7200. Again, that's 312-981-7200. I'm going to practice his last name during the break. The book is Perfect Pain. What do you do to numb your pain? We're talking to author Parham Parastaran in studio. He asked me to write it out phonetically. I'm not going to tell you how that looks. But Parham, I want to thank you so much for sharing this story. And I know that, you know, you're going to help. You've helped a lot of people already. And I know that hearing you tonight, you know, there are a lot of people who maybe are in their cars, maybe, you know, in bed, maybe they're, you know, doing the kinds of things that you've done before in your life. You talk a lot in your book about mastering the moment. Right. Knowing, you know, what you want. You wanted to be very popular in high school and you achieved that. You wanted to be very successful as a tennis coach, and you achieved that. Yeah, and then you became very good at leading a double life of running successful business in Champaign with your family. Was it auto parts and tires?
Auto repair.
Mm-hmm. And also, being able to race home when your dealer would have your supply ready for you, mm-hmm. and diving into that. I mean, the moment that you talk about the first time you tried cocaine and looking up at the stars and not seeing them the way you had, everything felt, was it crisp?
Crisp, yeah. Clear. It was, yeah. Well, you've done your homework, by the way, because that's exactly how I described it. But yeah, I remember just the stars looked brighter and the sounds were cleaner. And it was just this, there was just this really quiet, calm moment, I remember.
And you talk about chasing that every time you'd go home, and the moment before where you would get excited about it.
Yeah,
you would get excited about it, but also you have this devastation of knowing what you were about to do. And that's an interesting conflict. And I think that, you know, what people maybe they're not as self-aware to be able to know that, to sense that, those moments in between. Did you feel that way? Because it sounds as the way you write your book, that you can remember the moments in between, knowing when you weren't popular, you were the outsider, you know, moving to Champaign from being so popular in Gurnee.
I observed and felt a lot.
Yeah.
Except, so I wrote the book with a lot of feeling, and the feelings ultimately came in the book and how I felt in those moments. What the difference is, now this will sound tricky, is I felt and observed a lot while things were happening. This is going to be quirky, but I didn't feel it.
Right.
So even though I felt a lot, like I remember the feeling of getting, like when I talk about the bus, or the feeling when I first, you know, first time I tried cocaine, or the feeling of when I was abused. I remember those feelings,
right.
But I never incorporated the feeling into, like, for example, I vividly remember the feeling of going into the mechanical room with my cousin and when I would get abused, right? I remember that feeling. But I didn't feel if I was scared, or I didn't feel what it felt like.
Right.
But I remember the feeling.
Right.
Does that make any sense?
Well, and I think that sexual assault at that age is not, you know, do you think that's part of what might have, and I know you've done a lot of work on this, but you do now still, even when you hear the metal of a belt buckle, like that's, yep, so jarring and so hard. And I know that it makes sense to me that, you know, because you observe things so deeply and yet may not feel them, does it then, I guess, you know, that chasing, that trying to numb it, to be able to maintain not feeling that?
Yeah, I mean, that the belt buckle thing, you know, it's a trigger, because it's just, I mean, I just remember that dangling sound and whatnot. But I will tell you, Patty, when I talk about it and being abused and people ask about it without standing up, I feel like that was just an event.
Mm-hmm.
That was an event. I feel more hurt and pain and sadness of not having a connection with my parents to be able to talk about it than I do the physical act of being abused.
Because it's a sorrow.
Yeah, I mean, I can handle bad, you know, tragedy, bad things, tough things happen to people.
Right.
You know, they happen to us. They just happen. And my study and my observation with all this is that I could have handled being abused if I was connected with my parents and had a different relationship in a much different way than I was just having endured that on my own, completely on my own. So, but now today, now that I've worked through all that, those events, I love talking about it.
Well, and you talked a little bit before we started the show about some, you know, techniques in order to mourn the fact that you're never going to have the things that you want.
Yep.
You know, having that, whether it's that connection or having them understand, or, you know, having them say, or even say, I'm sorry, that happened to you. I mean, that's ultimately part of it, isn't it?
Yeah, we are constantly striving for wishes, fantasies, and wants that will never exist, that are in the past, whether they may be affirmation from your mom or affirmation from your dad, or needs that you have. In my 47-year-old body, I still wish and yearn for some of those other past things, and they carry with us, but the reality is that's never going to happen. It's never going to happen, and so they just keep coming up in modern-day events and life situations, but they really have nothing to do with today in 2019. They are really just inside your body that they never left.
It's almost like a memory in your, not necessarily, not just in your brain, but, you know, in your whole body.
Yeah. And not that you just want to let go of that fantasy, but it is a wish. It is a wish, and it is really important. You will always have that conflict. You will always be conflicted. Mm-hmm. You will always be conflicted if you keep chasing and not really getting to the point where you recognize that some of those things will never, ever be.
Right.
It will never be.
And how do you, I mean, you mentioned mourning strength. It, I guess, is strength.
Well, mourning is building strength. Yeah. Okay. So definitely mourning it.
Because I've talked to folks who, you know, as a parent of a child with a disability, there are a lot of parents who can never reconcile the fact that their lives are not going to turn out the way they had hoped, right? I don't think they're given necessarily the space to even mourn or the permission because they're in emergency mode. Now they're supposed to be these different kinds of parents. And that wish, like you said, I wish, you know, my child, my life wasn't so hard. And it's an incredible thing to be able to, and you also talk about the past and the future, and the middle part's the hard thing, isn't it? The right now.
What do you mean?
Talking about the past and latching on to regrets and things like that, worrying about the future and not living in the moment.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, huge deal for me. Constantly working on it. I think if I had a magic power, mm-hmm. I really would. If I had a magic power, I would have something that allows me to always live in the moment and be in the present. The reason we live in the past is for what we just talked about. We can't let go, and we can't, because we haven't resolved, not let go. You don't want to forget.
Right.
They're resolution. So things happen today that all of a sudden, you know, trigger memories from the past that are unresolved. And then also, because we are in this sort of state of anxiousness, we're all a little bit anxious if we're, you know, because we all have a little bit of depression. We all have a little bit of, we have stuff, okay? And so because of that, we tend to be forward-looking and thinking about what if this happened, what if that, or whatever it may be. But we tend to then still be stimulated by the future. And what these things do, they occupy your time. They sort of distract you from just being in the now and being in your own self today. It's a little Zen-like, and you know, but it's difficult for people to sit. You know how hard it is for people to sit? I've tried to do it. It's very difficult. Can you sit for 5 minutes just in pure silence by yourself and sit on the ground?
Mm-mm.
It's very hard.
I haven't done it in a long time.
I ask your listeners to see if they have or attempt to just sit with yourself in a room for 10 minutes without a phone, without anything, and just see if you can just sit in your own thought of that moment. Very difficult. There's reasons for that.
Yeah. And it's hard to like see, you know, you have a thought that floats through your head and just go, there's that thought and I'm going to let it go and say goodbye to it.
Usually future. And
Yeah. Let's take a break, and then we're going to go to the news in just a moment. The stories that matter from the Northwestern Medical Newsroom on 720 WGN. We're talking to author Param Parasuraman.
Man, you're getting good.
He's the author of Perfect Pain. More in a moment. While I was reading Perfect Pain, a memoir by Param Parasuraman, I was struck by the fact that you comment about how your family was saved, basically you were saved from sexual abuse because of the near assassination of your father.
Yes.
Because he was Baha'i you're in the middle of an Islamic war in Iran.
Revolution, yep.
And I mean, you remember, you asked your brother, why are they attacking us? And he said, because Saddam Hussein hates us. Mm-hmm. Which had to be so strange for a kid to go,
that question for my brother was when I was standing on top of my aunt's apartment in Tehran during the war between Iraq and Iran, the 10-year war, I believe, and looking up in the sky, and there was airplanes, and you know, they're just constantly shooting at each other. You just see these, like, it just looks like Roman candles. It looks like something you'd see in Chicago, like on a fireworks kind of a thing. But it was just really normal. But anyway, I was like, what's going on? And his short answer was that Saddam Hussein hates us, which was during the revolution. And it was also right around the same time of the Iranian-American hostage crisis.
And when your family came to the United States, your father ended up managing an apartment building in Los Angeles, and then moving to Gurnee. I'm so sorry, that shift from all of the beautiful weather to it makes me a little sad that your least favorite month is October.
Yeah,
but
is that your birthday or something?
No, I actually like the fall. I don't like what comes afterwards, but for you, it's the end of the sunshine and the trees, and you had spent a lovely time in California, and then moved to Gurnee. How hard of an adjustment was it? I mean, are you still, you just came back from Arizona, so now, I'm guessing snow is still tough for you.
Oh, I don't like the winter. I don't like the winter. I was in California short I wasn't a very, very long time. I think the crazy adjustment just was, and I said this in the book, and it's not, but I just remember being in California. It felt really clean and white. I just can't describe it any differently. Like, it was just blonde. Like, you think about it in 1980. You watch old 80s movies, and it's like, it's just like,
bright.
And I remember that. And then when I went to Joliet.
Oh, that's right, Joliet first, year, that's right.
Yeah. It was Joliet.
Yeah.
So the Joliet was in the chalet apartments, which was a subsidized housing. And it wasn't very nice.
Right.
And it was anything but nice. I mean, it was dirty. It was poor. It was
dark and drab.
It was dark. And frankly, I had not been around African Americans, and I had not been around Hispanic people. And everybody in the complex was African American and Hispanic, and maybe a few white people. And then, you know, I'm this Iranian guy that speaks with a little bit of an accent, and it was terrifying for me. So it was very major, 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 major conference. By the way, that chalet apartment's the reason my dad got that job. One of them was as a result of Paul's dad.
Really? Paul Farver?
Yeah.
I did not know that connection.
Yeah.
Now that even deepens the story for me.
His dad helped my dad get on his dad helped my dad get on his feet multiple times.
Well, and then when your folks, I didn't remember Yankee Doodle Dandy burgers until I was reading your book.
There were some in Chicago.
Yeah, well, in Gurnee, where your parents opened one. I thought that... I don't think people understand as deeply as people who are first generation. My mom came from Mexico, in a different situation. She came here for opportunity, you know, wanting to get away from, you know, whether it was the social or economic and, you know, the misogyny in Mexico. Your family fled to save their lives, not by choice, but by out of necessity. Mm-hmm. But you talk about how there's a shame of being in a country that you don't necessarily want to be in, and this longing of maybe being able to go back someday. But that's part of what drove your family to want to be successful here.
Yeah, I think there's no question. There's no question immigrants, and I'm supposed it could maybe go the other way as well, but I'm only familiar with
your experience
coming to this coming here. But I am certain a major degree of the ambition that a lot of immigrants get, the whether it's their work ethic, their desire to achieve, their desire to get betterment. Some of it obviously is driven by of the opportunities that they can and improving themselves. But I am certain that a major part of it is the shame that they feel in overcoming that shame, because they don't look and play the part of the people that are generally there around them, right?
Mm-hmm.
And now, obviously, the country's very diverse, but it doesn't change the fact that if I just came from Mexico, or if I came from India, or from Pakistan, or China, or Asia, or wherever, where I come here, and I'm trying to fit in, the quickest way to fit in and overcome that shame is success, because America loves success.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just rewards. I don't care what you look like, smell like, act like. If you're successful, for whatever reason, all of a sudden, you have respect. And they are just craving that respect.
Well, and you have a moment when you went in to ask for a loan to for a
the
tenant.
Banker.
Yeah. And you wanted, and he told you you needed to have somebody wealthy or
co-sign it.
And you decided, I'm going to have money.
Yeah, that was embarrassing. It triggered painful, shameful memories of being sort of a dirty immigrant that I was, and a poor, dirty immigrant, I should say. And it triggered my relationship with not having things. So I use the word poor, and I use that loosely because there's people that were quite a bit more poor. So I don't want to, you know, I want to be careful using that word. But my relationship with money was that we didn't have any, and it was very, very difficult. We had the basics. We had food and shelter, and that was about it. And so being denied, the banker being denying me simply just triggers painful memories of I hated that feeling of feeling poor. And they're motivational. But the poor, it goes with the shame.
And we also were talking about narcissism and just self-destructive behavior, which I think you put it so well, and I know this is off the air, but you said it's when someone's butting up against their core strengths.
Yeah. So a great example that I use that I think most people could understand. So if you're this what floor are we on?
The 18th.
We're on the 18th floor of this giant building. So when they decided to build this building, they got engineers together and structural engineers. They said, hey, we want to build a 30-foot story building. They built a foundation to be able to handle 30 floors, right?
Right.
When we set out to be Patty Vasquez or Parham Parastron, we don't know how many floors we're going to be.
Interesting.
So we have a certain amount of core strength based on the way we were developed with our parents' relationships and all these different things, right? And maybe I just had 11 floors worth of core strength. But somehow things go well. I become successful in the way we describe success, okay? And now all of a sudden I blow past 11 floors and I'm at 20 floors. But now I've only been built for 11.
Right.
And that's that narcissistic behavior. So is that's where you butt up against your core strength. Your core strength is how much your foundation used to be, and so you becomes a what we call in psychology is an inability to regulate your self esteem. You can't handle the success. You can't regulate the self esteem. So you're stimulating yourself, crash and stimulate, crash, stimulate, and you're constantly stimulating. Your self esteem, which every day affects us, is not regulated. Okay. And it's based on so many external things. And it gets regulated when we're strong and we're put together. Most people aren't, okay? So the self-esteem is all over the place. And that stuff, like with what we talked about, the example of Bill Clinton, or, you know, or Robin Williams, or who knows, you know, the people that commit suicide, actors and very famous, strong people. The story I always remember was, I can't remember his name, but the head of the IMF years and years ago, not that long ago, was potentially going to be the next president of France and sodomizes the housekeeper at one of the hotels.
Oh,
I mean, that's just crazy, right? Like, why, right? And it's that self-destructive, and that is that stimulus that you're trying to get from managing your self-esteem, and it's not regulated.
And how can people find regulation? I know you got to get help because you also talk about how, you know, your friend was surprised that you were depressed because you don't look depressed. You seem successful. You're the party guy. Everyone loves hanging out with you. You're popular. But we don't, I mean, depression doesn't have one sort of appearance.
This is why I'm thankful that I'm here with you today to talk about it, because I think what motivates me and especially writing the book and talking about it is that people really have a different understanding of depression. And I think maybe we're bringing some light to it, maybe with some of the more high profile events that have happened recently. Mm-hmm. But I really don't think people really understand. They think depression is just being in a room and being sad or like crying, you know,
somebody
that needs to go out every night.
Yeah.
Somebody that is obsessively working out. Somebody that is just doing things to ward off being warmer than the present. There's some depression there. It doesn't mean they you know, they're going to kill themselves, okay? And I'm not, and there's varying degrees of depression, but there's something there that needs to be looked at. And the awareness that I want to bring is to get help, is to talk about it. It doesn't have to be 1,200 hours of therapy like I'm doing. Mm-hmm. That's just a passion of mine because I just need to continuously self-evolve. But it can be it can come in very different forms. But it could be reading, studying, talking to people, but don't go through life not exploring the whys of who you are and why you are.
And get your structural engineering in gear.
Get your structure. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
That's right.
I think I got maybe 7 floors. I got seven, maybe 8 floors.
It's true.
Well,
it's
and so true. I think that I grew up with, you know, there are a lot of people who grew up with the shame of if you go see somebody, you're weak. And that's something else that we have to wrestle with.
This thing I told you at the beginning was it's unbelievable. Special, and it's really amazing the people that have reached out to me, but I can't tell you, and I'd love to be able to say who and what they have is, but trust me on this, that very, very powerful, very successful people, by again the way that we people have reached out to me that I've secretly met for coffee or been on a chat, you know, whatever, with that they wanted to tell me. I got letters in the mail, actual physical handwritten letters in the mail of them wanting to tell me, you know, I've been battling this and something like that. And, you know, do you want to go talk about it a little bit? And they're in their 60s. These aren't like 25-year-olds. I've had 25-year-olds, but a lot of these people are in their 60s and they're a little bit older.
It's never too late.
They're ashamed to talk about it. And again, that's why I wrote the book. I want it to be a power thing or a sign of strength to be able to say, man, I could use some help. We all can use some help.
I can use some help. We're talking to the author of Perfect Pain. It's Parm Parasuran, because he made me spell it out phonetically, and I appreciate that.
It gets
you know
better
why?
Every time.
I need a core strength. I need some core strength. More after this on 720 WGN. It's the Patty Vasquez Show. The book is Perfect Pain. The author is Param Parasuran. And I just got a text from somebody. Now, am I saying your first and last name better?
You're like, it's better than I say it.
So they've asked me to correct the way you say my name then.
Somebody sent you that?
My last name is Vasquez, not Vasquez. And I refrained from correcting you because we're having such a great conversation.
Vasquez.
Think of it
Vasquez.
As... Vasquez. Yeah, there you go. See?
Vasquez.
But I'll spell it out for you as well here. Vasquez. Does that help?
Yes.
See?
Vasquez.
But you, I mean, like every day someone says your name wrong. So I don't, you know, me too. I don't mind.
You know, every day people don't say my last name ever.
Right.
It's unbelievable. I just go by Parham because I've never needed to have the second designation because it's not like, is it Parham Parasuran or Parham whatever? It's
whatever just, I said the first
it's
segment.
It's just Parham because I don't know any other Parhams.
Parasuran.
Yes.
I wrote it up phonetically.
Vasquez.
There you go. See, now we're on the same page. And the pages of your book are filled with, you know, the perfect pain. This journey throughout your life and reflecting back on, you know, where how you got to, you know, the point where you were racing home from work to be there at the door when, you know, checking every room, making sure all the doors were locked and no one was there when you received your delivery of cocaine, and grabbing a bottle of whiskey or gin or whatever was on, and to that moment where you wake up naked, your wife is there, and there's broken glass. You don't know what happened. You don't know if she's okay. And this is a hard story to write. And for some, it might be a hard story to read. But I think for people who are struggling with depression or not understanding why they do things that might be, you know, that others, maybe they don't even think they're being self-destructive. If you talk to people who are like, this is who I am. It's part of my personality. I can't stop doing this.
Yeah, I just had a conversation this afternoon with somebody. But in general, people for some reason I find that are less self-aware than I've always imagined. And the more I talk to people sometimes, and the more I've studied people, because not only do I study myself, I study other people. I've been studying you all day. No.
I've been an open book for you.
I'm just but I do, because I learn from watching other people and things like that. And I just think when it comes to themselves, people have a difficult time being honestly self-aware. They are self-aware, but then they have their own narcissism. So narcissism and basically creates a certain they have certain vestment in themselves, mm-hmm. And so like the ostrich effect, you think about the things that you want to hear and want to see, and you tend to want to not listen and think about the things that aren't in agreement, that cause stress or anxiety. So we tend to want to only look at ourselves and our awareness of the parts that are easier to digest as opposed to causing stress or anxiety.
It's hard.
Very hard.
What I also, took into really to heart, and Paul will laugh when he hears this, because I love how much music really has an impact throughout the moments in your life. We have a segment on this show called Patty's Appalling Lack of Musical Knowledge. I never know who. So we were sitting at a restaurant where Paul likes to do his writing, and a song came on, and he goes, and Paul just stopped and he goes, this is my favorite song ever. And I go, oh, is this Gabriel Byrne? And he goes, first of all, that's an actor. It's an Irish, and I meant David Byrne. And he goes, okay, you need to stop, because it was David Bowie and Queen, and it was Under Pressure. And like the tears in his, it was genuinely painful for him. But for him, like, that's something that is in his core, is part of him. Yeah.
May I tell you something about Paul? When he says that this is my favorite, did he say my favorite song ever or all time or something of
yes,
that?
Yes, he said he listened to it over and over again.
When he was a kid on his closet, it was glass, and every single week he would write his top 10 songs, and it changed every other day. He'd be like, this is my new favorite song, this is my number one song, and he'd write these, my favorite song, and he did this for years and years and years and years. So when he says this is my favorite all time, I don't know.
I get a feeling
he's got 100 favorite all times.
I have a feeling the producer Tom Hush did a similar thing.
Well, I like to do notebooks. I always have notebooks that just sum up my favorite things of the year. year.
Oh, that's good.
I wanted to bring that up because we are moments away from midnight, and it will be the third anniversary of the passing of David Bowie. Were there musicians? And I know we have to take a break. Yeah, let me take a break, and we'll come back in just a moment. We are talking to author. Now I'm going to say your first name wrong, Parham Parasuran. He's the author of Perfect Pain, available at perfectpain.com as well as amazon.com. More in a moment on 720 WGN.